This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest is writer and director Greg Mottola. He directed the hit teen comedy Superbad, written by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, and he wrote and directed two critically acclaimed films, Day Trippers, released in 1996, and the 2009 film Adventureland, set in an amusement park in the 80s and starring Jesse Eisenberg. Mottola also directed several episodes of the TV series Arrested Development, Undeclared, and The Comeback. Mottola's new film, Paul, premiered at the South by Southwest Music Festival, Film Festival on Sunday and opens at theaters tomorrow. It's written by and stars Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, the English duo best known for the comedies Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. In Paul, they play a pair of English science fiction buffs who are touring UFO sites in the American West when they encounter a real alien named Paul, who ends up traveling with them in their rented RV. The creature is a computer-generated graphic, but has the voice and attitude of Seth Rogen. In this scene, Peg's character is driving the RV, and the alien Paul is up front, eating pistachios. Frost's character, who passed out upon meeting Paul, wakes up in the middle of the scene and attacks the alien.
I love pistachios. I hate when you get a closed one, right?
I usually just bite them.
No, you don't do that at all. You tap them. If they don't open on their own, you throw them away.
No, that's muscles.
No, it's pistachios.
Who are you? I am Cop Doctor. And this is Tums. He's okay. He's friendly. His name's Paul.
And it's Uncle Paul.
Was that Klingon? You psychotic nerd.
Listen, Paul is from a small M-class planet in the northern spiral arm of the Andromeda Galaxy.
Thank you.
He looks too obvious.
There's a reason for that, Clive. Over the last 60 years, the human race has been drip-fed images of my face on lunchboxes and t-shirts in case our species do meet. You don't have a spaz attack.
I did not have a spaz attack!
Don't do it again!
Well, Greg Mottola, welcome to Fresh Air. This film is a weird road trip with an alien, and it doesn't work if the alien doesn't work visually and isn't funny. Talk a little bit about creating Paul, the alien, his look, his personality.
Well, that was one of the reasons I wanted to make the film, because I like the challenge of making a CGI character that gave a kind of naturalistic comedy performance. We've seen CGI characters do a lot of things, but not so much that. You might say that in a all-CG film, but not so much in a mixed live-action CG character who's photoreal and has to have a kind of, you know, consistent, believable psychology. In the beginning, when we decided we wanted Seth to do this, one of the caveats was that Seth would not be available for the actual filming. He was going to go make The Green Hornet. So we knew we wouldn't have him on set. Hence, the lead actors, Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, and Kristen Wiig would be acting to a stick with ping pong balls for eyes and a script supervisor reading lines. And I thought, well, that's problematic.
Yeah, I just wondered, that's one of the first things I wondered, because in the film, I mean, the alien, it totally works. You totally believe he's in the RV with them and everywhere. And I'm sitting there thinking, how do you act if this is blank space?
You know, I went back and looked at E.T. Obviously, I studied a lot of Spielberg films and other sci-fi films from the period because they're referenced throughout the movie. So I was watching E.T. and I was thinking, well, you know, a big part of what sells this are the performances of those kids. You know, Drew Barrymore really makes you think she's meeting an alien for the first time. The creature design is amazing in E.T., but, you know, I knew that the actors had to sell it. So I turned to one of the co-stars in the film, Joe Latrullio, who plays O'Reilly. He and Bill Hader are paired up as these two ridiculous, comical federal agents who are in pursuit of Paul. And I asked him if he'd be the voice of Paul during the filming, and he said yes, thank God, and he was he took it very seriously. He would study tapes of Seth Rogen rehearsing the character so he could see what Seth was doing with it. And then he'd bring his own improvisations to the actual filming, which I think just made an enormous difference for Simon and Nick and Kristen, and to have someone they could play against, someone they could improvise with. And then later in post-production, Seth recreated some of Joe's ideas and lines and improvs, and, you know, it was this very strange theater troupe's, you know, vibe where people are trading the character back and forth. It's like, you know, sometimes there'll be a play where two different actors play the same part on different nights of the week.
Yeah, I'm picturing you doing this job of directing, and you know, and directing is, it's an artistic endeavor, but it's also this huge management thing because you have production schedules and big crews and budgets and all that, and so you've got this, you know, you've got these pre-recorded lines of Seth Rogen. You're trying to simulate what this computer-generated guy is going to look like on the set. Manage all the other actors, not to mention the fact that this movie also includes bar fights, explosions, car crashes. Gosh. It's a lot to manage, isn't it?
Well, and it was done on a budget. There are comedies where people are just sitting around in restaurants talking that have bigger budgets than this film. You know, there were places where the limitations were frustrating, for sure. For instance, we had action scenes, car chases and explosions. We had no second unit, which, you know, for the listener, most action films tend to have a second unit where a stunt coordinator is off simultaneously shooting the action bits. So the main production can be focusing on acting and so forth. We just had to kind of work it into our schedule, cram it in somehow. And I guess the fun part about that is I got to ride around in the little car that goes super fast that has a camera strapped to it. Although I feared for my life a few times. You know, it's I started out in indie films. This is quite different than shooting a 16mm film in 15 days like I did way back in the mid-90s on my first film, The Day Trippers. And I also, you know, my heroes are people like Woody Allen. I kind of thought I would only work exclusively in the world of, you know, naturalistic comedy drama. But there is the side of me that also loves Hollywood, and I wanted to see what that felt like. I wanted to see what it felt like to do special effects, and I don't think I'm going to dive right into a special effects movie next. My agents have asked me that. I said, I think I need two people sitting in a restaurant talking, but I certainly learned a lot.
You've done a lot of sort of character-driven stuff. I mean, your earlier film, Day Trippers, was, you know, it was this relationships among family members, and here you've got this sophisticated computer-generated alien. Kind of interesting that you're directing that kind of film.
Well, when I read a script, I always, the first question I ask myself is there something that I could bring to it that maybe the next guy wouldn't? Because I've read a lot of very good scripts and thought there are people who could do this better than I. What I liked about this challenge was that, in my mind, Paul should give a naturalistic comedy performance. So I felt that it needed to be played like a real actor would play it. He is a character in a road movie. He is Jack Nicholson in Five Easy Pieces. He just happens to be one of these people in the car. In fact, Simon said to me when I asked him point blank when we first met on this, are you sure I'm somebody you'd want to have do this? And he said, look, I saw your first film, Day Trippers, in London in the theater, and in a way this could be like that in places. It could be people driving around in a car and one of them just happens to be an alien.
An extraterrestrial.
yeah, it just happens to be. You know, we've all had that experience.
You had a big success with Superbad, the film with Jonah Hill, Michael Cera, and others. And I thought we'd listen to a clip here. I mean, this is, folks who saw the film will remember this. This is three high school seniors played by Jonah Hill, Michael Cera, and their buddy Fogel, who is played by Christopher Mintz-Plasse. And they want to get booze. And in this scene, Fogel, their nerdy friend, has gotten a fake ID just made. It happens to be a Hawaiian driver's license, and they're discussing whether it will work. Let's listen.
All right, that's good. It's hard to trace, I guess.
Wait, you changed your name to McLovin? McLovin?
What kind of a stupid name is that, Fogel? What, are you trying to be an Irish R&B singer?
Oh, they let you pick any name you want when you get down there.
And you landed on McLovin?
Yeah, I was between that and Muhammad.
Why don't you pick a common name like a normal person?
Muhammad is the most commonly used name on Earth.
Fogel, have you ever actually met anyone named Muhammad?
Have you actually ever met anyone named McLovin?
No, that's why you picked a dumb name.
Give me that.
All right. You look like a future pedophile in this picture, number one. Number two, it doesn't even have a first name. It just says McLovin.
What? One name? One name? Who are you, Seal?
Fogel, this ID says you're 25 years old. Why wouldn't you just put 21, man?
Seth, listen up. Face. Every day, hundreds of kids go into the liquor store with their fake IDs, and every single one says they're 21. How many 21-year-olds do you think there are in this town?
Let's stay calm, okay? Let's not lose our heads. It's a fine ID. It's gonna work. It's passable, okay? This isn't terrible. I mean, it's up to you, Fogel. This guy's either gonna think here's another kid with a fake ID, or here's McLovin, the 25-year-old Hawaiian organ donor. Okay? So what's it gonna be?
I am McLovin.
And that's from the film Superbad, directed by our guest, Greg Mottola.
There weren't that many bleeps. I was wondering how many.
Yeah, how are we going to do that on the radio, right? Right. These characters are decent adolescent guys, but they are completely obsessed with getting some sexual experience and getting alcohol as a route to getting sexual experience. How much like these guys were you when you were in high school?
I'm gauging the likelihood of my parents listening to this. When I read the script, I thought I completely relate to them. They are entirely inept. They don't know anything about women. It's rather sad. And I thought that's, you know, if we can make this feel real and psychologically accurate, maybe this movie will have some life to it. Yeah, I was a bit like those guys. I was an art student. I was kind of like – I became – the forger of IDs because I was had the best art skill. So I was like Donald Pleasance in The Great Escape. I was always making fake IDs for people, which is, and I'm sort of embarrassed to admit that. But
I think the statute of limitations has expired. This was the 80s you were making fake IDs?
Yeah. So yes, I had some of my moments like that.
Oh, gosh. And, you know, Judd Apatow was a producer of this film, and in a lot of his stuff, there's an enormous amount of improvising. And these were very young actors. Did they do a lot of riffing? Were you comfortable with that?
They did. I think maybe slightly less than a normal Judd film, just because the script was so specific, and Seth Rogen and his co-writer Evan Goldberg really wrote from their own experiences. There's some rather disgusting things that happened in the movie that were actually based on true stories. But having said that, these are some fairly remarkable young people, Michael Cera, Jonah, Christopher Mintz-Plasse. They are really inventive, funny young men. A lot of stuff that Fogel says, I always want to call him McLovin.
Yeah, I know.
Christopher Mintz-Plasse, who had never acted before in his life, was an amazing improviser. We read hundreds of kids for that part. Many of them who were working actors, and then I wasn't satisfied with anyone I was seeing. Everyone was kind of giving me the stock nerd character, and so we started to look for non-professional actors. And we put up flyers in high schools, and all these kids came in, and most of them seemed like people who had never acted before. And then Chris came in and played the character with this kind of wonderful arrogance that made it come to life. And a lot of the strange little phrases that Fogel says, all inventions of Chris.
Well, I want to talk about Day Trippers, which is, I think, a terrific film. And it was worth preparing for this interview just to be able to watch it again. And let me just kind of mention the plot, and we'll listen to a clip. It's about a family that lives in the suburb. There are two grown daughters, one played by Hope Davis. At home has found a romantic note on the floor, which might have been meant for her husband, Lewis, who works in New York City. This is a suburb of New York. Lewis works in New York in the publishing world. He's already headed off for work, and she sits down with members of her family. They say, oh, my gosh, what does this note mean? Is he having an affair? And they all decide to pile into the family station wagon for a trip into New York to ask Lewis about it. And there begins a remarkable road trip movie. And what we're going to hear here is some conversation along the road to New York. One of the sisters, played by Parker Posey, has her boyfriend along. He's sort of a pseudo-intellectual named Carl, and he gets into a conversation about his work that also brings in Annie Mira, who plays the mom of the family. Let's listen. Begins with Parker Posey.
Carl, tell Mom and Dad about your novel. Carl wrote a novel, everyone. It's great. It's just far out. It's brilliant.
I don't think your parents want to hear my novel.
Mom and Dad, do you want to hear about Carl's novel?
Oh, yeah, sure, Carl.
Well, Rita, it's an allegory about spiritual survival in the contemporary world. The main character is this freak of nature. He's this man who doesn't have a normal head. He was born with a dog's head.
A dog's head?
Yeah, you know, sort of a fantastical story.
It's like a fable.
Yeah, like Master and Margarita or...
Animal Farm.
Animal, yeah, exactly. Very Kafka-esque.
Carl, I'm not an educated woman.
It's Dr. Seuss for adults, Mom.
Oh yeah.
So, everyone else in the book is normal except for the man with the dog's head, who really only
what
wants...
What kind of dog?
Dad, it's not important.
No. It is important. Actually, that's very important. It's a German short-haired pointer. You see, it's actually especially important that it's a pointer, because that's a crucial metaphor, because in the book, he's sort of a visionary, you know? You know, pointing the way to salvation.
Joe loves dogs. Remember, Peppa? We had to put her to sleep.
Mother.
And that is from Day Trippers, written and directed by our guest, Greg Mottola. Fun to hear that again, isn't it?
I have not watched the film in over a decade, so it's a lot comes back.
Right. You know, as I read about this, it's amazing that you got – I mean, this is an impressive cast. You know, Liev Schreiber, Parker Posey, Stanley Tucci, Hope Davis, Anne Meara, Campbell Scott, Marcia Gay Harden. And from what I read, it sounds like you paid them like tortilla chips and Subway tokens. I mean, how did you get – I mean, these people were better known later than they are – now than they are then. But how did you get a cast like that with such a minuscule budget?
Well, one of the advantages of being in New York City and trying to get a career off the ground is that you're in a city filled with some very creative, talented people. And I got to meet some of them socially. I became friends with Campbell Scott, and he introduced me to Hope Davis. Another friend of mine from school had worked on the movie Dazed and Confused and knew Parker Posey, and Parker introduced me to Liev. And I just did a lot of begging. You know, the truth is good actors are always looking to do something different. They are dying to play slightly odder characters or work on movies that aren't straight down the middle. So I took advantage of that. And, you know, we designed the film in a way that if it ever got sold, we'd pay everyone back. So the upfront costs were incredibly low. We shot the whole thing for about $60,000. And, you know, in a weird way, because no one was telling me what to do, of course, it's an experience I want to recreate again, because it's a little trickier when you're, you know, someone else is footing the bill and millions of dollars are at stake.
Yeah. What were some of the obstacles that you faced in shooting this thing in, what, like 16, 17 days?
There are scenes in the film where there's just one single take on every person, where we didn't even get to do a take two because we had, you know, 12 pages of dialogue to do in one day. The first day of shooting, our camera had been stolen. We were unloading the truck and we had no camera. So by the time we scrambled and found one, we had 2 hours left. So, you know, I shot everything I needed from that location because it was a location we couldn't come back to in 2 hours. It was, you know, not ideal, but in a way it taught me something about resourcefulness.
Right. And the scene that we heard was inside a car. And it occurred to me as I watched it that it seems the camera was actually inside the car as opposed to, you know, traveling next to it on a mount or something.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things we had to resort to do it. I'm actually hiding in the back of the station wagon underneath a blanket with the sound man in all those scenes. Actually, in that particular scene, the sound was so bad because of the Long Island Expressway, we had to loop the entire scene. Everyone's voice had been replaced, which as a filmmaker, as I listened to it, I can tell. But I think we got away with it. That was very challenging. But, you know, it taught me some technical skills.
Yeah. You did a lot of directing in television for some really great shows. I mean, Undeclared and Arrested Development. You want to just tell us a little how you got into that and what that experience was like?
Well, when I came out of film school, I was hoping to emulate heroes of mine like Woody Allen and kind of write and direct my own small movies. And then I realized that that's actually quite hard to do. It's very hard to be Woody Allen. And I realized I just need to be working and I need to work with good people. And Judd Apatow called me, asked me if I wanted to direct an episode of his second television series, Undeclared. And I think before he finished the sentence, I yelled yes several times and essentially moved from Manhattan to Los Angeles immediately because I was dying to get experience. And it was one of the better decisions I've made in my life.
Is there an episode or a particular moment that you really treasure?
Well, working with Judd is kind of like comedy boot camp. He does have an amazing comedy mind. And you know, Judd was one of the first people who told me, you know, if a joke is funny but it's not moving the story forward, you have to cut it. You have to be disciplined. You have to, you know, or if a joke is counter to the character's psychology, you have to cut it. He has a real aesthetic about storytelling and trying to balance comedy and psychology and storytelling and plot and all those things. So I took a lot away from that. Judd also has a great kind of Mike Lee Cassavetes version of comedy where part of the reason he loves improv so much is that it puts the actors in a position where they don't know what the other actor is going to do. You can get lightning in a bottle with that technique because an actor's waiting for a line sometimes that's in the script and something else comes. And they have to be on their toes. And it elicits often a response that's quite surprising. And if the actor is really in the moment and very inventive, surprising, funny, wonderful things happen. And I really admire Judd's techniques in that regard. And TV, you know, the director is... It's not an auteur medium for directors. It really is the producer-writer's medium. As such, it takes a lot of the heat off of you, so you get to try things that are harder to try in features because there's so much pressure and so much money at stake. It was quite freeing to do television for a few years.
Well, there was quite a stretch between Day Trippers, which you wrote and directed, which I guess you finished making in 94 and opened some years later, and then Adventureland, which you also wrote and directed in 2009. In between, you did a lot of directing and television. But Adventureland I thought a really neat film. It's set in a family-run amusement park, and I thought we'd hear a scene. This is the central character, James, who's played by Jesse Eisenberg, and he's coming to get hired, I guess, for a summer job here at this little amusement park. They have jobs in two categories, games or rides. And he's speaking with the managers, played by Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig.
This is James, and he's applying for a games job.
Games? Oh, great. Good. Let's get you set up.
Actually, Bobby, I prefer a rides job if it's still open.
You look more like a games guy, plus I got out the games application. So, all right.
Yeah, no,
my name is Bobby. Okay, rules. No freebies. No free turns for your friends. No free upgrades. No free food.
So just nothing is free here.
Everybody has to pay for everything. And more importantly, working in games, no one ever wins a giant-ass panda.
Yeah, we don't have that many left.
Cool. Can you give me a T-shirt, please?
Here, I have a resume. I don't know if you still want to take a look at it.
James? Am I pronouncing that right? James? James?
Yeah.
Okay, by accepting this T-shirt, you are...
Hired.
Well, sorry. Usually more of a ceremonial thing.
And that's from the film Adventureland, written and directed by our guest, Greg Mottola. This is a fun film. Where did the idea come from, this film in the amusement park?
I did work at an amusement park one summer while I was in college. And I think I wanted to do a film about... I think the amusement park was kind of, in my mind, a bit of a metaphor for suburban life. You know, the kind of hand one is dealt... this sort of rundown, not very fun amusement park is kind of the best life has to offer for some people, which, you know, I like bittersweet things. I like things that have a tinge of sadness to them. I think amusement parks and places like that, I mean, if you listen to any Bruce Springsteen songs, you'll know what I'm talking about. They tend to gravitate toward that, or Tom Waits songs maybe.
Right.
I came up with the idea for this film when I was working on Undeclared, and I was surrounded by all these very gifted young actors and writers, and it started getting me thinking about my youth and coming out of college in the 80s and not having any idea what I was going to do with myself. And I just wanted to try and do, in my mind, was a short story, like a little suburban Chekhovian amusement park film.
You worked in an amusement park, I guess, in the Pittsburgh area, right, when you were young? Or no, it was in Long Island, right?
Yeah, I grew up on Long Island. I originally wrote the script to be set on Long Island, but that proved too expensive. So I ended up going to Pittsburgh, where I'd gone to college, undergraduate. I was an undergraduate student at Carnegie Mellon. I was an art student there. And I remembered this place, and I remembered it was quite old-looking, which was helpful because we were doing a low-budget period piece, and it couldn't look like it was from, you know, 2006.
I want to ask you one other thing. I know you're a big fan of Woody Allen, and you had a small part in his movie Celebrity, I think. And he told you that he really liked your film Day Trippers. And I've read in interviews that you can do a dead-on Woody Allen. Could you tell us what he said to you?
My Woody is pretty much based on other people's Woody Allen impression. But he did say to me when I came into audition for the role, he said something like, you know, I saw your film Day Trippers, and it was terrific. And then at that point, my life could have ended, and I would have been fine because I so worship Woody. And to have him say that about a tiny little film I made, it was the first film I made, I really I would have died happy in that moment. You know, the great thing is that I met my wife on another one of Woody's films. I had a tiny part in the film Hollywood Ending, and my wife, Sarah, was Woody's assistant at the time, and we became friends, and we had a friendship for several years that eventually turned into a relationship. And we're married and have three kids now, and we get to have dinner with Woody on occasion. And it's about the most wonderful thing. For anyone who's a Woody Allen fan, it's as great as you can imagine it would be. He's very happy to tell stories about his career, and couldn't be cooler.
Well, Greg Mottola, it's been fun. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dave.
Greg Mottola's new film, Paul, opens at theaters tomorrow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee's our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.